In the 1980s, a BBC drama series exposed the story of Percy Topless, a working-class anti-hero who was supposedly at the heart of the Etapel Mutiny in 1917. But what was the real story of the monocled mutineer? Last weekend, I was kindly invited onto the Modern Military History podcast presented by Andy Wheeler. Andy and I were discussing the film 1917, something that we've talked about on this podcast on many occasions, and there is indeed an entire episode about what I think about 1917 and how that relates to the history. And it was a very popular episode, which led me on to do one about All Quiet on the Western Front, and I've had quite a few others planned talking about the cinematic or film or drama presentation of history and how that ties into what we know of the facts of the real story of the Great War. And about a month ago, I managed to pick up a DVD copy of The Monocled Mutineer, which is a 1980s production. And that's what we're going to talk about in this podcast. But in that chat with Andy Wheeler, we were talking about the importance and the veracity and the believability of film and drama in the way it does present the Great War. And it fits into, for me anyway, a few different kind of categories, really. One of which is the depiction of landscape. It has to be believable, the landscape of the First World War, the Western Front or the Eastern Front or Gallipoli. The uniforms. Now, I'm not a kind of a button counter, but uniforms have to look right. You can't be wearing World War II battle dress and carrying number 4 rifles widely distributed in 1943 in a production about the Somme. So you need to have believable uniforms, but more importantly, the men wearing them, they need to look as if they have lived in those uniforms as real soldiers do, and not just taken them out of a costume cupboard that morning. So there's that aspect of it, the landscape, the uniforms, and I think the general believability of the story and how it ticks at least some of the boxes of our real understanding of the subjects of the First World War. In the end, while many films are based on real events, they are fiction. They're not documentaries, and we have to see them in that respect. So that kind of leads me on, that interesting chat that I had with Andy, which will be on his podcast soon, and I'll be putting up some links to that in the usual social channels. But that kind of led me on to bring my thoughts together to sit down, think about the Monocle Mutineer, a drama that I very much enjoyed watching in the mid-1980s, and put some thoughts into this week's podcast. Now, that period of the 1980s, which was when my journey along the old front line began with that very first trip to Ypres and then the Somme in 1982, the 80s was a period in which there was quite a lot of First World War related drama on television. There was, for example, To Serve Them All My Days, that drama based on the Delderfield novels about a school teacher returning from war, shell-shocked by his experiences as a young officer in the trenches. Although the series was about many wider issues of interwar life and social life, there was a lot of references to the First World War, and the trench scenes where he had flashbacks to his experiences in the Great War were something that I remember very clearly, and they had quite an effect on me. And I think when I look back on them, I've watched that series a couple of times since, it was very well done. So there was that. There was also Testament of Youth about that time. I can't remember that's the late 70s or early 80s, but it was certainly shown again in the early 80s, and I remember seeing it, where that talks about the love affair between Vera Brittain and Roland Layton, a true story but dramatised for television. And when I was a student, there was that very cold winter where we were all cut off and the roads of Britain came to a grinding halt in deep snow and frozen ice, and everyone was at home watching television. Very few channels in those days, hard to imagine, I know. And there was this obscure drama, I think, on BBC Two, which was called Anzacs, which was about the experience of a battalion of Australian soldiers from formation through Gallipoli through to service on the Western Front, and then the aftermath. And that's a series I think we will certainly come back to in this podcast another day. But there was a lot of this kind of stuff on. And Monocle Mutineer, which came out in 1986, was kind of part of that canon of Great War drama that came on in that 80s period, which was, I now know, a period of really good drama generally, particularly on the BBC. And it was written by Alan Bleasdale, who was quite a famous writer at that time, highly politicised, well known for his left-wing political views. This was a period of polarisation of political views with the miners' strike and a period of Margaret Thatcher as Prime Minister. I mean, something we don't need to go into here. But he was very much a voice of that period. And when you watch his work, there was always a left-wing leaning to the way that he wrote things, rightly or wrongly. We're not kind of criticising or even approving of that here. The historical advisor on the series was a friend of mine, Julian Potowski, who with Julian Sykes wrote The Shot at Dawn book, which was a groundbreaking book that came out in the 1980s about the men who were executed in the First World War. And the series, which was a four-part series on British television, was a classic piece of drama that I think when I watch it again, it does not feel dated at all. And in the lead role was Paul McGann as Percy Topless, his first big role, really. And I think the success of the series, and it was hugely successful, I don't have the kind of listening figures, but it would have been in the millions in those days. Its success was down to the way that he carried that role and the way that he was. He's an excellent actor. I've had the privilege of meeting him out on the Somme battlefields where he was filming a kind of obscure film called Poppies about a teacher from Bradford who goes to the Somme to write a play about his grandfathers who were there with the Bradford Powers. Anyway, we're getting slightly off the subject here. So a four-part drama written by Alan Bleasdale, Julian Potowski as historical advisor, Paul McGann in the lead role, and a lot of famous faces from British television of that period. It was drama, but is it history? Well, of course, it is and it isn't. As we've said, it's a work of fiction, so it's drama first and foremost. But what of its history? Is its history believable? Is the landscapes of the Great War that it depicts, are they believable? Do the men look and feel as if they could be soldiers? And is there a general believability to it? And I think when I look at the kind of feedback that was in the press at that time, and I ended up writing a little piece for our local newspaper in Crawley in Sussex where I was living, and they even got a local veteran who had been at Etaples in 1917 to comment on it. I think they even had veterans on Wogan talking about the series. So it had a big impact on the public at that time. And I think a lot of people watching it, as is so often with film and drama, that's the lens by which they learn about a particular subject, something I was discussing with Andy on his podcast at the weekend. And a lot of people probably saw Monocle Mutineer and thought, yep, this is a true story. But is it? What it does is focus on Francis Percy Topless. Percy Topless, the so-called Monocle Mutineer. This arrogant, adventurous larrikin of a lad who is out there dressing as an officer out of the trenches and getting away and getting up to all kinds of shenanigans. It's based on a book called The Monocle Mutineer by John Fairley and William Allison. I'd never heard of the book until the series came along. It was one that I picked up in paperback. It came out, I think, in addition to do with the release of the drama. The book is very interesting in all sorts of ways. You can pick it up pretty easily. I'll put some links to it onto the podcast website. There's no footnotes or sources in the book at all. Nothing about where they got the information. And when you read it and when you know some of the context of the Great War, a lot of it just does not sound right. And there is a quote that I remember which kind of summed it up for me. And this is it. This is from the ending of the original edition of the book. And still defying the British Army, Percy Topless has his own place of honour, gazing arrogantly down from a photograph on the shelves of the Imperial War Museum, dressed in the uniform of a lieutenant. Old soldiers and their exploits never die, nor do they entirely fade away. Now that was the ending of the book, implying that somewhere in the Imperial War Museum was a photograph of Percy topless looking down on the unsuspecting public who walked through the doors of that museum in the 1980s. Something that is completely, totally untrue. There's never been a photograph of him on display there, and the well-known photograph of him as an officer, which I'll put on the podcast website, who knows if that is even him? It's credited as being published in a newspaper of the time, but I can't find it. If you can, send me a link to it. I'd love to see the original source of that photograph being published, but who knows where it came from? And when I look at that book by Fairley and Allison, a lot of it feels as if it's almost made up to create this fantastic story. It's kind of faction, the odd fact mixed in with a hell of a lot of fiction. So what will we do in this podcast then? We'll look at the series. We won't kind of do it blow by blow, but we'll look at aspects of the series and what it tells us about the First World War and the story of Percy Topless. And then we'll look at the real story of the real Percy Topless. Who was he and what happened at Etaples, the mutiny for which the Monocle Mutineer gets his title. We'll look at that and the real story of what happened there in 1917. So let's look at the four-part series, The Monocle Mutineer, shown in the 1980s on BBC. The first episode is called The Making of a Hero, which kind of immediately sets the stall out for what the writer thinks Percy Topless is. And it starts in sepia with a sequence of him post-war, post-First World War, on the run from the police. At this point in his timeline, he's wanted for murder, and it shows a photograph, this famous photograph of him in officer's uniform. And then it cuts to colour, to childhood, so it goes back in his timeline into his early life, where it's quite clear as we watch this that Percy Topless is a difficult child. As someone says, he was not known at Sunday school, so he's not really respectable or respected. He's kind of at a loose end, and it results in him getting into trouble, which leads to him being birched as a young man, a very severe penalty, often for very minor infractions. He grows up in a Nottinghamshire mining community in that Edwardian period before the Great War, and it's clear that he's really not much more than a lazy, feckless youth who doesn't really know his place in the world, always in trouble, and he runs away, gets into more trouble again and again and again, leading to not birching this time. He's past that. This time he's going to prison, and he's sent away for a short term of imprisonment in Lincoln Jail, and he comes out just after the outbreak of the Great War. You then see him in recruiting drives in the Lincoln area, and he finally enlists. He's finally prompted to enlist. There is a streak of something in Topless. Occasionally you see him doing kind of the right thing, often for the wrong reasons, and certainly not for selfless reasons, but there is a streak of something in him that I think is what endears him as a character to many of those around him. And he's given a white feather when he's in a pub, and that's what prompts him to join. He's not liking, you can see that people are thinking that he's some kind of coward, so he goes off to join up. And we're not initially told what it is he joins. He's in Lincoln. Could it be the Lincolnshire Regiment? We see recruiting sergeants with the Lincolnshire cap badge, but it jumps then to the Western Front and the Battle of Loos in September 1915. As we look at the uniform that he's wearing, we can see some red crosses on his upper sleeves and the cap badge of the Royal Army Medical Corps. So he's not joined an infantry battalion or a fighting unit. He's a stretcher bearer in an RAMC, Royal Army Medical Corps unit. Most possibly, given the circumstances, a field ambulance, because there he is in the trenches. He's the link between a dressing station, either a main dressing station, an MDS, or an advanced dressing station, an ADS, and the men in the front line where the regimental aid post is, and the battalion stretcher bearers. And this is the first sequence in the series depicting trench warfare. Now, I don't know where they filmed this. Taff Gillingham's trenches did not exist then, and I suspect these were specially constructed somewhere. I know, for example, with Oh What a Lovely War, made in the 60s, that they went up to the Corporation Tip in Brighton, which was full of rubbish, dirt, muck and everything, and they dug a set of trenches up there. Where these were dug, I don't entirely know, but they are pretty good trenches. They're well constructed. They look like First World War trenches with duck boards, trench supports, fire steps, sandbag parapets and parados. I mean, I'm sure we're seeing the influence of the historical advisor, and the uniforms are good. And talking about the believability of uniforms, as we mentioned earlier, when we look at this, this does not look as if the cast have just been dressed. These are not clean uniforms. They're dirty, they're filthy, they look as if they've slept in them and they've been wearing them for a long time, which I think is important in the depiction of soldiers in battle. If they're wearing starch clean uniforms, how is that even possible, particularly on a battlefield of the First World War? And we don't just see British uniforms, we see Scottish troops in this as well. Lewes was very much a Scottish battle with 9th Scottish Division, 15th Scottish Division, kilted troops taking part in the action there, and it ties into that. And there he is in the front line with his comrades. You get to know about his little section, his mates are around him. It's a good insight into ordinary soldiers and their little world of friends and what is important and what annoys them. And what annoys them is their section sergeant who comes round and gives them a hard time. In the battle scenes, we see them going over the top. We've just done a recent episode about gas in the First World War, and Lewes was the first time that gas was used by the British, and we see that depicted in this episode where a Royal Engineer officer gives orders to his men to release the gas. The soldiers go over the top, including topless, with their gas helmets on, so rolled up on their heads. And then gas is released and blows back onto the attacking troops, and you see men vomiting as the gas overwhelms them. And that depicts obviously an actual episode from the Battle of Lewes in 1915, perhaps not entirely in this way, but what they're trying to address here straight away is the darkness of the trenches, the mud, the lice, the rats, the dead, the conditions on the battlefields, and now here is the horror of gas. So it kind of ticks those First World War boxes that we expect to see in drama about the First World War. I mean, the whole war wasn't like this, but it's popular drama, and there were aspects of the war in which all these things were a factor. So it's not that it's unbelievable, far from it. And then it moves to behind the lines, and we begin to see that the kind of larrikin, the kind of difficult individual that Topless had been in civil life, he's exactly the same as a soldier. Mucking around, not taking things seriously, getting himself into trouble. And then they go back up the line and you begin to see other aspects of trench warfare. Stokes mortars, and then he witnesses an attack of an infantry unit, which obviously they're picking up casualties from, go over the top and go into action in a later stage in the Battle of Lewes. Possibly this depicts one of the assaults on Hill 70. It doesn't really specify where it is. Topless is horrified by what he sees, the madness of it in his eyes. He's an anti-authoritarian individual, and he looks at the conduct of the officers and the higher-ups and sees that they are firmly to blame for men going over the top and being mown down senselessly in no man's land. So again, it's not a surprise when we see this kind of writing and this kind of depiction of the First World War through the pen of Alan Bleasdale, considering his own political views. And while the 80s was still a period in which the likes of Alan Clark with the donkeys and John Laffin with his cutting remarks about the generalship, particularly the British generalship of the First World War, all of those ideas still, they held ground really in the 1980s, and it was only at the beginning really of that being challenged, much of that early work being done by historians like John Terrain, for example. So that kind of lions led by donkeys view of the First World War was pretty much the popular perception at that time, and this drama fits well into that idea of the First World War, an idea, of course, that we would now challenge greatly. So what we're already seeing through Topless and his comrades and their view of a battle that ends in a failure with costly casualties is disillusionment, is a rejection of what the war is about and an idea that somehow this war is wrong. And the next sequence that we have ties well into the historical advisor's own research, Julian Potowski, doing as he was at that time, the research for the book Shot at Dawn. We have a sequence that depicts an execution, and topless as a stretcher bearer, and this again was not uncommon. REMC men were often present at executions alongside the chaplain, alongside the officers that were in charge of it, and topless is volunteered. He's given a cuff remark to his sergeant and he's volunteered for special duty, and it is to go to this hut in a quarry where a man is being held. Initially, topless doesn't know the reason, and then he discovers that the man is about to be executed. And when he finally confronts it with him, the others who are in the hut with him, they keep dancing round the subject, but topless confronts it straight away. And the man who is sentenced to death says, "I funked it, old boy." And the way he talks, immediately you get the sense that this is not an ordinary soldier. It transpires when he questions him that the storyline is that this is a man who had been an officer. He'd funked it. He'd shown cowardice in battle in front of his men, and he'd run away, and he'd been tried by field general court-martial and been found guilty and sentenced to death. But what it puts across is the false idea about shooting officers, because what's happened to this character is that he's been cashiered, he's been reduced to the ranks, he's no longer an officer. They can't shoot an officer, so therefore they cashier him, they take his rank away from him, and they shoot him as an ordinary soldier. Now, that is not what happened to officers who were executed for cowardice or desertion in the Great War. They were tried as officers and they were executed as officers. There's one buried at Poperinger, there are others buried. I mean, only a handful of officers were executed compared to ordinary soldiers, but they died with their rank. So this is really a highly politicised narrative of the First World War that we're seeing here. And the character says to topless, "They promised not to tell my mother," which is a theme that kind of returns later on in this episode. So they drag this poor soul out for a firing squad. The firing party we see are all drunk, which I'm not saying never happened, but you're a firing party, you need men to be able to fire straight. Would you get them all blind drunk? You see them pin a target to the chest of the soldier and it doesn't kill him. The volley from these drunken soldiers, unsurprisingly, doesn't kill him. So an officer steps forward and issues the coup de grace. Not before he's got up from the chair that they've strapped into and tried to run towards the firing squad. And that's when he's put out of his misery. Topless, Percy Topless, is disgusted by the whole thing. It reinforces his own class view of what the war's about and how incredibly stupid those who are supposedly in charge of this war are. Again, all part of that highly politicised narrative of the First World War that this series is. But this was, the interesting thing about this was a moment in television that was quite important because it was the first depiction of a battlefield execution of a soldier shot at dawn since the 1960s film King and Country, starring Tom Courtney. And that in itself produced an awful lot of public debate. Hang on a minute, we shot men like this in the First World War? And it began the momentum that in some ways, through the work of people like Julian Potowski and his work on executions in the Great War, that would eventually lead to those men who were executed being pardoned under Tony Blair's government. One of the outcomes of the execution for Topless is that he ends up having to go to the army store where they keep all the uniforms and equipment and personal items being sent back home to the families of soldiers who died on the battlefield. He's there to make sure that this executed soldier's property goes back to his family, and he suddenly realised that in these stores there are piles of uniforms, including officers' uniforms. And this gives him an idea to dress up as an officer, to somehow make up for what had happened to this soldier that he'd seen executed. I think that's what inspires him, is to try and regain some of that man's honour. He died in such a dishonourable way in Topless's eyes that you get the sense that he's trying to make some kind of amends for him, whatever his reasons may be. And with Topless, there are always selfish reasons involved in that. So we then see Topless dressing as an officer, passing himself off as an officer and mingling with other officers. Now, is that possible when we look at it? Well, of course, any soldier could have snuck into a store and stole some uniforms. I mean, there are a lot of accounts of personal items being taken, being thieved from these stores and not getting back to the families. Pens, rings, jewellery, family items that were meant to have been found with a body when a soldier was killed, and they never get back to Britain. And they were purloined by whoever and sold, swapped, who knows what. I mean, there are stories of that, but it's not unconceivable that a man could go in there and steal uniforms. Could he pass himself off as an officer? Possibly. This is 1915-16, when to be an officer, you've got to have gone to a particular type of school, come from a particular type of background. Would topless, giving his working class credentials and life, could he have done that? He says that he was in Lincoln Jail with a gentleman and he learned a lot about being a gentleman, in inverted commas, from him. That is all possible, I guess, but soldiers and officers carried identity papers, and to move around, particularly behind the lines, they often required passes or chits or all kinds of things, a bit of paperwork to justify that they were there. And these could be regularly checked and were regularly checked by the Corps of Military Police, the Military Foot Police, or the Mounted Military Police, whoever it was operating in that area. So whether somebody could have regularly pulled off impersonating an officer, particularly during a period of the war in which there was a lot of security scares about Germans dressing as officers and trying to get information within the British armed forces on the Western Front, I'm not entirely sure about that. I think it's kind of a weak plot arc in this to believe that someone like Percy Topless could do this, not just once, but pretty regularly. But it's drama. So I guess that's the storyline. He dresses as an officer to get away with things and do things that no ordinary soldier could do. And then he goes home on leave, takes an officer's uniform with him, turns up in his old colliery town and gets men who had given him a hard time as a youngster, who are now part of the local volunteer battalion, to march up and down on his command. And that's when that famous photograph is taken, supposedly of him as an officer, which is meant to have been displayed all those years later in the Imperial War Museum. He then goes to see the mother of the executed soldier. And it's at that point when you're watching it and you're seeing how Topless handles the conversation with the mother. She has no idea, apparently, of how he died. She tells Topless, how did he die? And she'd not received any kind of communication from his comrades as to what had happened to him, implying that the War Office lied about what had happened to executed soldiers. Whereas, in fact, we know that they sent letters to the next of kin of executed soldiers explaining what had happened. Whether they then shared that with anyone else is another thing, something we've looked at in a previous podcast about soldiers who were shot at dawn. And when she asked him, how did he die? Topless refers to that moment where he tried to get up from the chair and ran forward at the firing squad, got hit by bullets and was finished off with a coup de grace. He describes that to the soldier's mother as a very special kind of bravery. And it gives her some comfort. And you think, perhaps Topless is not as bad as we think he is. And then, of course, he turns the whole thing round and it becomes about him. And he swindles the mother out of some money. She says it was an act of great kindness that he came to tell her these things. And with a wry smile, he looks at her and says, no, no, I assure you it wasn't. And there we see, I think, the real Percy Topless, the swindler, the liar, the cheater, and all those other things. The anti-hero, of course, others would say. And that leads us into the second episode called Before the Shambles. It moves on a bit to June of 1917, and Topless is now at Etaples, the main infantry base depot for the British Army. Etaples, heel taps, eat apples, all kinds of names the soldiers gave to it, had become this main base of the British Army following the closure of the base at Rouen and the movement of it here to the French coast so it could be nearer to Boulogne, where the bulk of troops was shipped across from Folkestone to Boulogne. And here we begin to learn about what Etaples is. We see the vast cemetery, and there is a vast cemetery here to this day with 10,000 dead. We see burials in the cemetery. We see women involved in the conflict now, members of the Queen Mary's Army Auxiliary Corps. We see training in the Bullring, the sand dunes where soldiers are doing bayonet practice. We see shots replicating some of the official photographs of Etaples. It's quite a clever piece of television. And the yellow armbanded instructors known as the Canaries, we get to learn about those. Men who were from reserve units, men who'd often never seen any kind of combat, shouting and bawling at often very experienced soldiers. And we see depictions of field punishment as well, both field punishment number one and field punishment number two. Field punishment number one being the cartwheel crucifixion, where they tied men to posts or cartwheels. So the series was a first, really, in kind of giving us this drama depiction of how soldiers were policed and punished in the First World War for the many military crimes that they got up to. We're introduced to the Etaples base commandant, who's played by Timothy West. This is Andrew Thompson, his real character, who was the real commander of Etaples in 1917, and a fictional character, his assistant provost marshal Strawn. It's quite clear from the narrative of this and the way that Topless is shown viewing them and talking about them that these men are buffoons. They fit into that kind of stereotype of what senior officers were meant to have been, which of course we now know to be very different. And it shows the men doing pointless task after pointless task, and even Topless himself being involved in bayonet training, bayonet practice, which as a soldier in the Royal Army Medical Corps he would not have been doing. And we learn as well about the women at the camp, not just those in uniform, but the civilians who were there, with the character of Lady Angela Forbes, played by Penelope Wilton. It's based on a real person who had opened a kind of tea and bun stall and canteen there for soldiers at the time. There were quite a few of these at different places, Etaples, Rouen and other base locations. And she, we discover, had been protesting about the conditions at the camp. It was a transit camp. It was a place, it was an infantry base depot, a base depot for the whole army on the Western Front. Men were only meant to be there for a short amount of time to get some in-theatre training before they were posted up the line. There was a brutal regime running it. Discipline was all. It was very different to the kind of camaraderie and the comradeship that men had experienced in the trenches. It was not liked by anyone who ever went through it. All of the veterans that I interviewed who went through Etaples hated it. So it was not the best place to be, but the way the army thought that it needed to prepare its men for the kind of warfare, the kind of experience they were about to walk into when they went up the line. And in Lady Angela Forbes' canteen, Topless meets Strange, who's played by Matthew Marsh, who is a left-wing idealist who Topless takes to. He sees a better man than himself in Strange, and he tries to help him. Perhaps he sees the kind of man that he wishes he was himself. A principled man with real ideas who is doing something for the greater good. And through Strange, he discovers that there is an army of deserters living in the sand dunes around Etaples. And after a period in the line again, up at Arras this time, somehow Topless is back in the Etaples area and he decides to desert and ends up with these deserters in the sand dunes. Now, it is known that there were some. We kind of see what is a pretty substantial force of them in this programme. I'm not sure it was ever quite that big. One of the characters claims there's thousands of us in these woods, in the wooded areas of the dunes and the downs around Etaples. But nevertheless, it's another part of the story arc, and it keeps Topless close to Etaples, where the mutiny begins in September 1917, and Topless is very much at the heart of that. We see a group of troops on the bridge over the Conche River, depicting an actual episode during the mutiny in 1917, and there's a disturbance going on, a big thronging group of soldiers. Claire Grogan, who was famous at that time as a pop star and actor, she's there as the QMAC talking to a Gordon Highlander, and an MP fires in the air and the Gordon Highlander is mortally wounded. and this results in a riot, and the Eat Apples mutiny begins. Men push over the bridge into the town, and all hell breaks loose as they go crazy in the town. You see, over the course of the depiction of the mutiny, rape, pillage, fights, even deaths of military personnel, which is a very, very exaggerated view of what actually happens. Topless, when it kicks off, is playing cards dressed as an officer with other officers, and then he makes his way into the throng of it and makes sure that, seeing how the men are treating officers, he makes sure that he's dressed as an ordinary soldier. In fact, he ends up dressing as a kilted soldier in the Gordon Highlanders. And Thompson is shown during this phase of the mutiny to be panicking, not sure of what to do. He continues to be depicted as a complete buffoon who has lost complete control of this situation, which to a degree is true, but is again an exaggerated view of what happened at Etaples in September 1917. And this episode then goes into the third episode in the series, which is called When the Hurly Burly's Done. And here we see the riots in and around Etaples are continuing. It moves to Thompson's office. The mutineers, wearing gas masks to disguise their faces, make demands, and Thompson replies, "I will not be spoken to like this by a colonial," which aggravates the Australians and New Zealanders that are there. He refuses to sign their demands and then is tipped into the river. Now, none of that happened, and he signed nothing. What you see with Topless amongst all this really is narcissistic behaviour. He's burning the world for the sake of it. He's got no agenda here except his own, which is this confused state of chaos that he's trying to create by releasing prisoners, by allowing things to happen, by fighting amongst the men who are carrying out the mutiny. The whole thing really has no clear purpose when it comes to Topless's own role in it. At the time, the men themselves probably were motivated by a number of things. They knew they were going up the line to an uncertain future. They were prevented from going into the town to visit places where they could get strong drink and cheap women. I mean, that was the reality of it. There were a lot of prostitutes, brothels in Etaples that the men wanted to get to. And while all of that was a kind of consideration and perhaps even an impetus for some men to go crazy while they could do, you don't see any of that with Topless. He, as I say, is just throwing petrol on the world while it burns for the sake of it. And I guess that's all part of the idea of showing him to be not a hero, but an anti-hero. Thompson, the base commandant, is seen to be defeated. It appears that somehow Topless is responsible for this because he's jumped in a car with him, got him to sign some demands. We know none of that actually happened. And then the troops arrive to quell the mutiny, to quell what's going on, and the Etaples mutiny is over. And we're then left with the aftermath of that, which is the deserters involved in the uprising, including Topless, are now on the run. And they've brought in a special agent to deal with this, a chap called Edwin Woodall. Woodall was a real character who wrote a book called Detective and Secret Service Days in 1929. And he claims in the book that he was brought in especially after the Etaples mutiny to clear up, to get rid of this band of deserters who were living in the dunes and living in the woods. The book kind of reads like a bit of a boy's own, and he really bigs himself up in this book. And we've got to treat it really with a degree of caution, I think, but it was obviously used by the writers of the book on the Monocle Mutineer and by Alan Bleasdale as a major source to create this character that could hunt down and capture Percy Topless, which is exactly what happens. Woodall dresses up as a padre. We see Topless in an estaminet playing the piano. They surround it with military police, and Woodall goes in and he arrests him. Topless has finally been detained, and this is Woodall's golden moment, really, of his career. The whole thing feels like a total fantasy, really. And it's an interesting story and an interesting story arc within this drama. But did it happen? No, absolutely not. Not like this, and not with Topless. And just when you think Topless's war, Topless's life, it's all over, he escapes from military prison, goes on the run, meets a character called Dorothy, falls in love, and the story changes. You see him re-enlist after the war under an assumed name. He carries out crime while in the army, leading to a murder. He goes on the run, and then he's caught by the police and shot dead in 1920. And that's all in the fourth and final episode of the series, ending with him back where we started on episode one, on the road at Penrith in Cumbria, pursued by the police for murder. He's dressed in civvies, he's carrying a wartime service revolver, and he comes out with that kind of immortal phrase, really, looking back on his own life: "When I had nothing to lose, I always won." And now he's met Dorothy, he's fallen in love, he's got something to lose, and his life has gone all wrong, and it's all fallen apart. And of course, as so often with a narcissist like Percy Topless, everyone else is to blame but him. And in that final shootout with the police, he's the one who's killed on that road at Penrith in June 1920. Now, when you look at these four episodes, and I'll put a link to where you can get DVD copies of this, it's not available online as far as I know. It's an excellent piece of drama. There's a lot of dodgy history in it, but it gives you a flavour of the First World War, from the depiction of the trenches, what we see of the war. It gives us an insight into military discipline. It gives us an introduction, an idea of the base camp at Etaples and what was happening there during the mutiny. It ticks quite a lot of really good historical boxes, but it is fiction. The story is not real. This concept of a monocled mutineer, of an ordinary soldier from a working class community in Nottinghamshire wearing a monocle, passing himself off as an officer and getting up to all kinds of shenanigans, impersonating officers and gentlemen and being at the heart of the Etaples riots and mutiny, none of that is correct. I could think of a more impolite word for it, but that's exactly what it is. It's just not correct. And the history, the real history of what happened at Etaples, and the real history of Percy Topless, the man who died on that road in Cumbria in 1920, that's what we'll look at next. We've had an overview of The Monocled Mutineer, the series, and I would urge you to try and seek it out and watch it. It really is worth watching. Paul McGann is excellent. It's an excellent piece of drama. So given that, what though of the history? What when we actually look at the real story behind what happens at Etaples in 1917 and the real story of the real Percy Topless, how does that connect with the facts? So who was Percy Topless? The Percy Topless that we see depicted as the character in the drama began in that working class mining community in Nottinghamshire, goes to prison, joins the army, serves on the Western Front in the Great War, and then deserts, goes on the run, becomes a criminal, murders someone, and then is killed by the police in 1920. So that's the kind of time frame that we've got for the Percy Topless depicted in the drama. Is there anybody that matches at least some of that? Now, we've got a fixed point, and that's his death in June 1920. And there is only one man who was shot by the police while wanted for murder who connects us to the military records of the Great War period, and that's a Percy Topless in the Royal Army Medical Corps. But before we come to him, there are, in fact, three Percy Toplesses who served in the Great War. The first of those joined the 7th Battalion York and Lancaster Regiment and served on the Western Front, but his records survive when we can find those on the usual sources like Ancestry and Find My Past. his records survive, and we know from those that he served on the Western Front from December 1917 until November 1918. So his period of service is too late. That's after the Etaples Mutiny of September 1917. He's from the right part of Britain, Long Eaton, and he was aged 21 and 1 month in May 1916, but the rest of it, that does not fit. So he's a Percy Topless from the Midlands, but he's not the right Percy Topless, and he is not a man that was shot by the police. The second Percy Topless was in the 7th Battalion, the Leicestershire Regiment. He was an original enlistee into that battalion, served overseas with them from July 1915, and was wounded in the fighting at Bazentin Wood on the 14th of July 1916, so badly wounded that he never served overseas again, and in 1917 transfers to the Labour Corps and serves in Britain with them for the rest of the war. So he has no overseas service in either 1917 or 18. So he could not have been at Etaples, and there's no connection with him and a soldier on the run and a man wanted for murder who was shot by the police. So those two Percy Toplesses are to be discounted. The one where we do find mention of the incident in 1920 is the Percy Topless who joins the Royal Army Medical Corps, which is the right unit as depicted in the drama series. But when we look at his surviving records, there's no service record for him. There's only his medal index card and his medal roll. And the medal index card, and I've put these onto the podcast website so you can see them, says that he went to 2B Balkans, Theatre of War, on the 11th of July 1915. Now that was the code used by the Army Medal Office as it was then, for Gallipoli. So he went to Gallipoli in July 1915, probably given that date via Mudros or something like that. And he was either in a unit, Royal Army Medical Corps Field Ambulance, in probably the 11th Northern Division or the 13th Western Division. Because his records don't survive, we're not entirely sure which one. And that probably places him at Suvla Bay, that second phase of the Gallipoli operations. He goes from there, no doubt, to Egypt. And we know from some post-war records, police gazette records, that he then went to Salonika. So perhaps he changed RAMC unit. Perhaps he got sick at Gallipoli, which wasn't uncommon, particularly as a medic, and then transferred from a field ambulance to another field ambulance or a casualty clearing station or a field hospital, whatever it was, but he ended up in Salonika. And later in the war, he transfers to the Army Service Corps. Now, on his medal index card and his medal roll, it states that he deserted on the 26th of December 1919, re-enlisted in the Royal Air Force in 1920, and was fatally shot in Penrith in June 1920. And the quote on the medal roll says, a warrant for murder having been issued against him. So this is definitely the man that was shot in Cumbria in 1920. This man did not serve in France and Flanders. He served at Gallipoli in 1915, when we see the character of Percy Topless supposedly being in the Battle of Loos, and then he served in Macedonia, as the troops called it, Salonika, so did not come to France. And if he was still serving and had not deserted, he was in Salonika in September 1917 when the Etaples Mutiny took place, not in the heart of the action on the coast of France at the base camp of the British Army on the Western Front. So that means this whole story of that Percy Topless, the murderer killed in 1920, cannot be connected to the other parts of the story that we see depicted in the drama. Percy Topless did not serve at Loos and was not at Etaples. And the book that tells us that he was can only be based on poor research and a mixture of too much fiction in that faction that the book really is, that mixture of fact and fiction. That's putting it politely. So it kind of destroys the credibility, really, of the whole story. And when people watch that series and think, there he was, good old Percy, good old Perse, fighting for the working class lads in France and Flanders, at the heart of the Etaples mutiny, the real Percy Topless, the criminal, he was not there. So it kind of destroys that story. And this whole idea of him dressing as an officer, ending up back in Nottinghamshire in officer's uniform and having his photograph taken, it makes me wonder if that photograph, supposedly of him as an officer, you can see there are Army Service Corps badges on his collars. I wonder if that is from much later on. That is when he was on the run after 1919, pretending to be an officer. The Police Gazette, which I'll put the entry for that on the podcast website as well, the Police Gazette says he was known under a number of aliases and often referred to himself by the rank of captain. Is that image from then, not from this supposed period of leave during the war? I mean, probably we'll never know, but none of the facts add up to the drama. The drama is fiction. The real Percy Topless did none of those things that we see in the drama series. So Topless was not there. What of the depiction of Etaples? I mean, that is a podcast in its own right, and I do intend to return to Etaples at some point. But there's an excellent little book, an excellent little account of the Etaples base camp, the history of it, and the type of units and personnel, men and women who were there, written by Julian Potowski and Douglas Gill in the 1990s, and published in the town of Etaples for an exhibition that was in the town museum there for a long time, where they'd done some archaeology on the camp and found all sorts of artifacts in the dunes and where the rubbish tips of the base camp was. And that gives us the real truth behind what life at Etaples was like during the Great War. It's not easy to find. Occasionally copies turn up in places like eBay. Well worth looking out for. In that, we learn the truth about what happened at Etaples on the 9th of September 1917, when the mutiny erupted after a New Zealand gunner was arrested after overstaying his leave. He ended up in a detention camp that was then besieged by a couple of hundred soldiers of the New Zealand Expeditionary Force, and this crowd, this group of men, was then swelled by other men and personnel who were exiting a camp cinema nearby. And the grumbles at life in the camp and conditions in the camp kind of grew, and this was a flashpoint really for it. And very quickly there was nearly 2,000 angry soldiers in this mob. One officer of the military police, probably military foot police in this case, fires up into the air with his pistol, and a woman is wounded a few streets away by the ricochet of it, and he also fatally wounds Corporal W.B. Wood of the Gordon Highlanders. Now that episode, as depicted in the drama, is pretty spot on. Military policeman firing into the air, and Wood is fatally wounded. You'll find Corporal W.B. Wood's grave at Etaples if you visit that cemetery. He was the final flashpoint, and that big crowd of soldiers seeing one of their own hit and drop, they went crazy. And they came flooding over the bridges, flooding through the streets, down into Etaples, pursuing the military policemen who were fleeing in the wake of these angry soldiers. The camp adjutant then tried to restore order with 200 men from some of the infantry-based depots. These were the camps often related to specific formations like divisions, where their men would be sent in there, trained up, and then sent as drafts up to the division in the front line. He got a group of these 200 men from these different infantry-based depots together. They had weapons, but no ammunition. They looked threatening, but they had no bite to their bark. And further trouble continued, but was often locally contained by the officers talking, reasoning with the men. That wasn't always possible. And the camp commandant, Thompson, so depicted in the series as a buffoon, came out regularly and again talked to the men, calmed them down, and tried to restore order. And on several occasions, he was successful, but it was very clear that this was getting out of hand, and in the days that followed, it got worse and worse. On the 12th of September 1917, so this is, the third, fourth day into the mutiny, pickets were placed on the bridges over the river in front of the town of Etaples. It's a coastal town with a river that runs through it, with several bridges to get into the town, and pickets were placed on those bridges to stop the men coming from the camps, the base depots, into the town itself. But the men who were part of the pickets, the officers that commanded them, one of those, as I mentioned, was interviewed on Wogan when the drama series was first showed in the 80s. They were reluctant participants in this. They didn't really want to have to use their weapons against their own guys. And a crowd of over 1,000 men pushed past them and over the bridges and into the town. And the whole thing got completely out of control again. And this time, the War Office, the High Command, the BEF reacted to it and sent in several army units that were pulled out of the line near Ypres or that were out of rest in the Ypres area, were sent to Etaples to kind of surround the camp, really. And this included a battalion of the Manchester POWs, a battalion of the Royal Welsh Fusiliers, and the Honourable Artillery Company. And they restored order, and order was restored generally within the camp by the 15th of September. So this went on for nearly a week. Now, despite the claims in the series where you see these big crowds of soldiers going crazy, no women were molested or raped or assaulted. The Queen Mary's Army auxiliary personnel were contained within their own huts, and their senior officers talked down the men that surrounded those huts, and they weren't disturbed again. We don't have a lot of evidence about what happened to the civilians in Etaples who were in the path of these mobs of men running riot through the streets. That's something that needs a lot more research, even now, I think. And what the account by Julian Potowski and Gill refutes is the idea of there being a central ringleader as such, and they dismiss completely, despite the fact that Julian Potowski was the historical advisor. He fell out with Alan Bleasdale, and at the time I remember him saying that if Alan Bleasdale could prove that Percy Topless was at Etaples, he would give him the most expensive bottle of rum on the planet, or something like that. And in the book that was published in the 90s, he again refutes this idea and categorically states that the riots, the mutiny, Etaples had absolutely nothing to do with that Percy Topless who was shot by the police in 1920. What they do say in this book is that 54 men were court-martialed for various offences connected to the events within the camp. And one of those, Corporal Jesse Short, of the 26 Northumberland Fusiliers, was the only one who was executed for it, executed for mutiny. One of a handful of British and Commonwealth soldiers to be executed for mutiny in the Great War. His execution took place at Boulogne some weeks later on the 4th of October 1917, and he's buried in Boulogne Eastern Cemetery. His trial papers survive, and you'd expect, considering he was the only man convicted of mutiny, that there would be some kind of mention, even if not by name, of a Topless-like character, or an inference that maybe it wasn't Topless, it was Short. There's none of that. So that doesn't really give any credence to the story of Topless and his involvement as the monocle mutineer in the Etaples mutiny. The events of Etaples, which we will return to in a future podcast, did change, I think, some of the ways that the army looked at itself. There was a great fear, particularly after the Russian Revolution, of Bolshevism in the British forces, of the idea of Republican agitators, is a phrase that you see commonly used within the BEF. But there's no evidence for that. It seems to have been a group of soldiers disgruntled with conditions, not knowing what their future may be, and given no chance to go into town for war, wine and women, then that seems to have been part of what inspired them to do what they did. And also seeing one of their comrades shot dead by the military police. There's never a great love between serving soldiers on the front line and the military police forces of any army. So that inspired a lot of the anger and the rioting that was seen in the early stages of the Etaples mutiny. And it didn't bring an end. Thompson was dismissed. not in the same kind of circumstances that we see in the drama, but he was dismissed in October 1917. Etaples wasn't sidelined as a base depot, far from it. It remained as the base depot for the rest of the war, and thousands, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of soldiers passed through it in its period as the main base depot for the British Army on the Western Front. The war marched on, the use of Etaples marched on, the training at the base camp continued, and soldiers were prepared for battle and sent on the trains up towards the forward zone of the battlefield to take part in the great battles. In that final year of the Great War, Etaples was, for most soldiers who fought during that time, their conduit, their way, their route to the battlefield. A route that took them onwards, ever onwards, to the old front line. You've been listening to an episode of The Old Front Line with me, military historian Paul Reed. You can follow me on Twitter at SomCor. You can follow the podcast at Old Front Line Pod. Check out the website at oldfrontline.co.uk, where you'll find lots of podcast extras and photographs and links to books that are mentioned in the podcast. And if you feel like supporting us, you can go to our Patreon page, patreon.com/oldfrontline, or support us on Buy Me a Coffee at buymeacoffee.com/oldfrontline. Links to all of these are on our website. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again soon.